Good afternoon. Sláinte, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. Coming to you live from the Hertz Bunker, somewhere in the ward. My name is Scotty Hertz, and once again, pleased to join you this week. I am also joined on the line by our chief assignment editor and the man of who wears many hats, Adam A. Donaldson. Adam, are you with us?
Oh, yes.
Oh, excellent. Good. That was Barry White there for a second. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here, baby. Today on the show, the second half, Adam will be speaking to our MPP and leader of the Green Party of Ontario, Mike Schreiner, to get all up to speed on the budget that dropped at Queen's Park, and also probably a bit about COVID and some other things. I haven't heard it yet, but very much looking forward to that. Also, before that, we're going to talk a bit about the poppy flap this past week, culminating yesterday with Remembrance Day, but prior to that, there was a bit of a to-do in the province, and we're going to get into a discussion about that a little bit. But first off, the discussion that's probably still the prevailing one in, the U.S. likes to say it, controls the world, but the topping today's world news, the U.S. election persists in its its prevalence, because Donald Trump still has not conceded the presidency, although it sounds like almost everybody, including certain Republicans, have said, look, you know, you should probably let Joe Biden do this, get access to resources, get access to his mail. It sounds like he wasn't able to get the greetings or the congratulatory messages from world leaders. I don't know how they send them now. Is it still Telegram like Putin sent not that long ago? I'm not sure, Adam, but do you think we're going to see a bit of a crack opening in terms of Trump's approach to this, or is he just going to continue doubling down until the 20th of January?
I don't know. It's so bizarre how quiet he's been. I mean, other than Twitter, of course, but, Twitter is kind of his safe space. But, I mean, there's been no public events save for the annual trip to Arlington for Veterans Day.
And it sounds he was late for the Arlington presentation, right? Did I get that right? He's like,
I don't know if he was late, but I mean, I saw him, I saw the video of his arrival, and I mean, it looked like there was no place he would rather not be. And I'm anticipating like any day now that there's going to be like a Maggie Haberman story about, they had to send in like six aides and Jared and Ivanka to, you know, convince him to go to that, you know, that he didn't want to go. He didn't want to be out in public. He didn't want to see anyone. I mean, the fact of the matter is he's, and I saw this mentioned last night on CNN. He's been working late, and by late I mean late for Trump, like 7 or 8 o'clock at night in the Oval Office. But it's not the pandemic he's working on, or it's not, you know, economic recovery measures. It's, you know, meeting with people trying to figure out how he can win this election that has, you know, already been called. And I mean, the unfortunate part is that the Republicans have not been vocal enough. I mean, there are some positive signs, like James Lankford of Oklahoma. He's one of the senators from Oklahoma who said that, you know, Joe Biden should be receiving the presidential daily brief.
I believe Lindsey Graham said the same thing today. Like, let him see the stuff. And he's a tight Trump ally. It doesn't get much tighter than that.
No, and Lindsey Graham, once again, showing that there isn't an ounce of bravery in his whole body, only said that after Lankford did. But even that Lankford, if you read Lankford's whole statement, it's couched in this, you know, President Biden, or he doesn't say President Biden, he said, Vice President Biden should be getting the presidential daily brief until we count all the votes and we know for sure who's won. And it's like, dude, he's won. Unless, you know, there's magically, you know, 5.4 million ballots marked for Trump hiding somewhere. Mm-hmm. it's game over. It's kind of bizarre that even just like sort of the basic fact of, you know, just like the basic things to get started, like the signing of this release of funds from the general. It's called the GSA, the general. I can't remember what it stands
yeah,
for.
Yeah, it's the transition head. Money so that the new administration can get set up and rolling, right? I can't remember the name.
Right, they can establish office space. Like there's an actual office of the president elect, and they have a budget. They have access to office space. They're supposed to start getting government resources so that they can start the background checks of people so that they can get security clearances so they can, you know, just be ready on day one to start the work of running the White House. And that is not happening. And there's, you know, 70 days for that to get done in. And it's, I mean, first of all, it's galling that we're not having any regular order in terms of the turnover of power, which has sort of been the hallmark of, you know, the democratic order and since, you know, the start of the country. But I mean, it's also galling in the fact that you have people talking about, well, this is kind of where it went wrong, where it started to go wrong in 2001, where because of the court actions and the recounts in that race, the George W. Bush administration wasn't allowed to start its official transition until well into December. And so they're already starting a month behind. And so they're missing like security briefings and all that. And I mean, that's not to say that it was a direct cause of the security mistakes that led to 9/11. But you can definitely say that they were starting off on a back foot in the George W. Bush administration because of all the stuff that was happening in 2000. Well, I mean, is history going to repeat itself here? It's not like there aren't dangers for the incoming administration to face, not necessarily terrorist dangers, but that could happen. But, you know, there's a pandemic and an economic downturn and demands for greater accountability and social justice. So, you know, there's work to be done.
Yep.
And just because Donald Trump doesn't want to work anymore. I mean, this is the other thing, too, is like, I don't know why he wants to be president. He's clearly not interested in working, but
yeah, well, some would say that he never wanted to be president if you go back in time and look at it. But also going back in time, a lot of what Trump said in 2016 when he won, even when he won, he was saying that, oh, this election was a fraud, and he was, you know, spilling like he is now about, well, what's the latest, you know, the ballots being thrown in the river and dead people voting and all the stuff that he had said back in 2016, even though he won. So it's almost if back then he was setting it up. It's like, okay, 4 years from now, if and when I lose. But the difference now is that the margin, it isn't a slim margin. The last posting I saw on the seat count with the Electoral College was 290 for Biden, right? So it's not as if it's 269 to 271. I mean, that's, and 5 million plus votes, whatever it is. Georgia had said that, you know, because the margins are so slim there, they're going to have an automatic recount. They're going to audit everything. They're going to re-canvass. I'm not even sure what the re-canvassing involves. I guess it's going back to people and saying, hey, is this your signature? So it sounds like they're on top of it. It's not as the stuff that Trump and others are saying is almost completely unfounded. Right. And there again, as I had said, there's some Republicans too. It's like, you know, it's not really fair of you to say that the democratic process that we put so much into is actually garbage, which is what he's saying. And of course, I've been following him on Twitter. I know you do too. He seems to have switched from Fox to something called Newsmax. Do you know anything about Newsmax? I didn't want to click on it at all because I think I know what it is or where it's going to go. Breitbart and Newsmax are the new favorites. Fox is out because Fox betrayed him, I guess, to some degree. But Newsmax is it the sort of organization that I think it is? It's probably just
Newsmax is between OAN and Fox in that it's very Trumpy. It's kind of like situated itself to be the pro-Trump network, not necessarily the pro-Republican or right-wing network. It's a pro-Trump network, but it doesn't quite engage in the conspiracy stuff that OAN does.
Or Breitbart. I mean, it's right on the line then.
Yeah, that's not to say they don't flirt with conspiracy. They just don't sleep with it. It's worth noting, one of Newsmax's bright shining stars is none other than Sean Spicy Spicer.
Oh yeah, because I saw you had retweeted him there, and you're like, "Yeah, no kidding," or whatever you put. Spicy's back. I didn't realize he was. Yeah, until you tweeted that, I didn't realize he was actually on the radar anymore. But
he's still on the radar.
Wow, I wonder if he's stayed COVID-free, because it sounds like something that I noticed. I think it was in the New York Times, and at least 30 people within the White House sphere now have COVID, including. Ben Carson is one, but who am I thinking of? Mark Meadows. Mm-hmm. Mark Meadows is the person that said we can't control COVID, has COVID. So I mean, you can't control COVID if you don't try, right? If you're not trying, if you're going to a party, I guess, as Ben Carson did, to celebrate the Trump loss or whatever they're calling it now. And yeah, it's 30. That's amazing. And it's probably going to be more. But, you know, Commander in Chief got it. So he decided to share, it would seem. So if anyone was hoping for a smooth transition, this is probably one of the only predictions I've gotten right, you know, I've said in the past. So it's going to be so-and-so, and it hasn't been. I was like, you know, if it's Biden, this is going to be a rough ride, and definitely, definitely not making it easy. He's also started firing people, right? Is it, you know, there's what, 70 days left in the game? It's like, you're gone. I never liked that guy. He's gone,
yeah,
too.
He fired Mark Esper, who is the defense secretary. That seems to be a long simmering beef, because Esper came out shortly after the whole Lafayette Square debacle and said that that was not a good use of military assets, you know, firing tear gas on peaceful protesters. And then, yeah, there was kind of a clearinghouse at the Pentagon high-profile positions, and these people have been replaced by MAGA idiots, like this one guy, Tata, who once called Barack Obama a Muslim terrorist.
Oh.
And this other guy, McGregor, who used to be a general, basically said that Germany was going to be torn asunder because they were letting migrants from Syria into the country at the rate they were letting migrants in. So, I mean, these guys are prize acts. So,
a couple of final bright shining stars in the waning, what seems to be the waning days of administration. It's looking that way. But I wonder if Trump is holding out for one of his famous deals. Right. I wonder if he's doing all this to set it up so he can get some kind of deal, pardons galore for all of the stuff that's going on in the background there, or some of it, or it was kind of like, who was it? Mugabe in Zimbabwe. It's like, okay, give me this X amount of money and 10 cars and an entourage, and I'll never bother any of you again. I wonder if it's like that. But then I keep hearing he's thinking about running in 2024. So is that his way of saying that he has actually lost? It's like, well, you know, not this time, but I'll be back in 2024. Newsmax top correspondent, gonna run for president again. And who knows, maybe America will be ready for him again in 2024. If the place isn't swimming in COVID cases by then, and it hasn't, you know, completely dissolved.
I think the confusion is reflective of his own, like, inner tumult. And Mary Trump, I was listening to a podcast she was on, made this point that what's especially girding him right now isn't that Republicans lost, because for the most part Republicans won. They did gain seats in the House. They held on to the Senate. There were a couple of new governors and, you know, state house victories too. It was him that lost. He stands alone in the losing. Like, if the whole party went down with him, I think he would probably feel maybe a bit better. I mean, I somehow doubt that, but I think a lot of the tumult and the speculation about what is he doing, why is he doing it, what's he going to do next, I don't think even he knows. It's also reflective of just the history of this administration, which has been to just get to the end of the day, get to the full lid, go to sleep, wake up tomorrow and start again. And I think that is just that is the extent of the complication of what's happening right now.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. I have no doubt that we're going to be talking about this again.
mm-hmm.
And again and again. But yeah, at least up until January 20th. if not sooner. What's something that has happened sooner? Which yesterday was Remembrance Day, as we know. And this flap almost came out of nowhere, Adam. I mean, I know over the years there's been, you know, discussions about poppies and, you know, do people get the meaning and are they the, do they mean the same as they did before? Tim Hortons, as we know, are there's always every year there's obviously not this year, but every year somebody steals the poppy box from Tim Hortons. So that's generally poppies in the news. But this year the flap was to do with Whole Foods, an American company, as we know, owned by Amazon and Jeff Bezos, had changed their dress code and said, no more anything, including poppies. We don't want anything making a statement. And then the heavy artillery came down on that for at least a whole day, perhaps two, where this was front of mind. And I was going to say Amazon, technically Amazon, Whole Foods backed down, like, okay, you can wear the poppies now. They're going to come after us, so.
Yeah, it's one of these controversies that I don't know. It speaks to, I think, and you know, don't at me, but I mean, there's a very performative aspect to our patriotism at times, and a lot of it comes down around Remembrance Day and the poppy. I think of Don Cherry a lot,
and his poppy, you know, blazer. Yeah.
Right, and he's all about, like, oh, I love the troops, do anything for the troops. It's like, did you surf? No, of course he didn't. He grew up playing hockey and wanted to be a hockey player and became a coach. And so, I mean, so, you know, what values are you really talking about, Don Cherry? And I feel like some of that's along these lines, too. The other part of it is, and from what I gather, this came from an employee at a Toronto area Whole Foods. And I think actually most of them are in the GTA. There's like 14. First of all, there's 14 Whole Foods across Canada. And
they have to be in places where people have money. So, yeah.
Just GTA. I looked this up. There's 54 Atlantic Superstore grocery stores in Atlantic Canada. And that's all. That's the only place you can find the Atlantic Superstore is in Atlantic Canada, and there are 54 of them. Meanwhile, there are 14 of these Whole Foods stores, and everyone loses their mind. Anyway, from what I understand is an employee went to the CBC and said, hey, just so you know, we're employees at Whole Foods. We wanted to wear a poppy. We have a new policy about not wearing stuff on our work uniforms that promote a cause. The poppy is included. I asked my supervisor about it. The supervisor said, no, we can't wear a poppy. This could have been solved so simply in-house. It could have been solved with this employee saying to her supervisor, like, look, you know, there are 14 of us in Canada, 14 Whole Food locations. What are the odds that this is going to get back to someone in the upper echelon of Whole Foods or its corporate boss, Amazon, that this is going to be a thing and that we're going to get slapped around? And I mean, coming from my years working in retail too, I also know supervisors, and I've had some very good supervisors, but a great many of them too are also you know, quite happy to operate in their little fiefdoms as tin-plated dictators with minor powers. I'm not saying all supervisors, but definitely some, and this seems like a case of that. Also, you know, having been in the back rooms of a lot of corporate retailers, you know, there's a poster there that says, if you have an issue and you can't take it to the manager, you can call this number and bring it to the attention of the company. Why couldn't they just say, hey, worker here in Toronto, we wear poppies in honor of remembrance? Because keep in mind too, American company, so you know they don't wear poppies in the United States, so they don't know. So, you know, we do this thing on Remembrance Day to honor the troops. It would be really cool if just, you know, for this one week, you know, you let the policy slide, and we can all wear our poppies, and nobody has to go to the CBC and start, you know, telling tales out of school.
Yeah.
And you know, problem solved. But instead, we had this fracas.
Yeah, and I did a bit of a dig because the question is, what changed? I as well have worked retail and worked in supermarkets, and we were, this is going back a bit, but we were actively encouraged to wear a poppy. Not, it wasn't mandatory or anything, but I mean, I did work in a neighborhood that had a lot of people that were veterans still alive back then, particularly World War II. So what changed from last year with Whole Foods? Well, I can tell you, because it was kind of linked to from the, and I had posted this, the article by Nora Loretto, which I can't quote because it has a lot of F-bombs in it. Passage.com, check it out, because she pretty much let everybody have it in this regard, but also mentioned, you know, a list of things that have happened to the Canadian troops this year. So anyway, and people that know me know that my life is completely shaped by the large global conflicts of the 20th century. I won't get into it too deep because this isn't about me at all. But, oh my God, where was I going to go? I did the spiral there. It's about the poppies. Yes. What changed? So what changed at corporate? Well, in the States, in the middle of the pandemic, I think it was in July, when people started wearing masks to work because that was a mandatory thing, the branded mask came online. And we've actually seen it with branded masks. Every politician worth their salt these days is wearing a branded mask with a poppy on it, right? You've seen it. I'm going to say particularly the conservatives are the ones that have noticed, but you can get a mask with any brand or logo on it you want. Initially, you couldn't. But when that was starting to come online, there's cartoon characters, sports teams. There's even messaging masks like LGBTQ community. But then somebody in a Cambridge, Massachusetts Whole Foods wore a Black Lives Matter mask to work. And they were fired, sent home. So, exactly. They said, there's a no logo policy. You can't do that. And they're like, well, wait a second. Everybody's wearing all kinds of stuff. And they said, well, this has nothing to do with this person. But it turned out, not only at that particular Whole Foods location, there was one in Berkeley, California, New Hampshire, Seattle, right across the states. People were being sent home. I just think this one person was fired, but people were like, you have to take that Black Lives Matter mask off. Where was the outcry then? There wasn't one. It was like, we're going to shut this all down. There's no symbolism whatsoever, which leads to this. Months later, here up in Canada, where the dress code has changed corporate universally. Because it's Whole Foods. I was in the Whole Foods in London, in the UK. So they are worldwide. I don't know what happened if anybody was wearing a poppy in London, because they do, that's where it in the UK originally. So that was the change. I was trying to find out, like, well, why? What is the issue? So, but then the doubling down happened, and Doug Ford and co. don't have to talk about COVID for a day, which is probably taking out a lot of veterans, or will if we get the rates that we're getting right now, right? They're able to not, they don't have to talk about that for a day because they can talk about the poppy, right? It's poppy, poppy, poppy. And that's the problem, because the symbol has been completely, in my view, co-opted, because I remember almost the exact moment where it became not about remembrance. You'd go to a Remembrance Day service and it was about remembering. Bill Weingart in town, fabulous speaker, and always, it was always about remembering that we don't want this to happen again. 9/11, Canadian troops go into Afghanistan, the tone completely changed. And I stopped going to Remembrance Day services because it became about something completely different. It became a bit of a propaganda tool, in my opinion, rather than just remembering. It's like, well, why did we send all these people in? Or why, you know, asking the question rather than, well, we're just doing this because you have to support the troops. And that's the tone. And I think it's wrong.
And I would also point out, too, that, you know, hearing Doug Ford come out and saying, we're going to pass legislation that says you can't ban or you can't stop people from wearing a poppy. It's like, what does that sound like, Doug? Does that sound a bit like cancel culture? Yeah. You're going to cancel anyone that says don't wear a poppy? What about free speech, Doug? Aren't you the guy who's always going on about college campuses not allowing free speech? And it's like, you're right. It has become, and this goes into the whole idea of performative patriotism too. I remember years ago when my Ontarian days, there was a controversy on campus because I think some group was like promoting wearing a white poppy instead of a red poppy, and boy.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Was this the controversy to end all controversies? Like, how dare you wear a white poppy? And the whole idea of wearing a white poppy is that it's supposed to be a peace symbol as opposed to a symbol of remembrance of people in war.
But the origins of that go back as far. The origins of that are 100 years old as well. It's not as if somebody just came up with it, right? It's a parallel thing.
Right. And so, I mean, that's always been a part of it, too. And, of course, Aaron O'Toole gets in on this.
Of course.
Maybe Whole Foods should be less focused on being woke foods. And it's like, dude, no. It's like we could all – like it wasn't just a matter of going at Whole Foods. And, again, it's a matter of just like this could be handled much more subtly. It's saying, you know, look, Whole Foods, dudes, I know you're Americans.
Whole Foods,
and,
dudes, yeah.
And you don't really get it. But, you know, this is what we do up here. This is how we remember the fallen. And if anyone's going to get that, it's going to be the United States, which has a proud history of, you know, recognizing the valiant sacrifices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not that I'm yada, yada, yaing the sacrifices of veterans at all. But it's just there are ways to handle this that weren't this. And it felt like everyone got to jump up and down on Whole Foods for a day. Maybe it's kind of a bit of a release valve because we're all trying to behave ourselves with COVID. Friends are enemies are friends. But the tone of it was just kind of disgusting that anyone who doesn't wear a poppy on their lapel on November 11th isn't Canadian. They're not one of us. Oh, and, you know, and meanwhile.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, veterans get treated not well in this country. How many veterans are on the street? How many veterans have mental health issues and can't get help? Forget about veterans for a sec. I can't believe I just said that. That'll come back to haunt me. But think about Amazon. Think about how Amazon is treated. Those people in fulfillment centers aren't getting danger pay anymore. They're still expected to meet their quotas. They're still expected to run around a warehouse for 10 hours to fill, you know, 50 orders an hour or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get mad about something, get mad about that stuff.
Does King Midas Bezos, sitting in his $200 billion, and that's no exaggeration, care? It's something like this, he would just want it when it would get to his desk, even if it did get to his desk, because there's probably 10,000 middle managers for it to get through before it got to Bezos. It would be, make this go away, you're making us look bad in this market, right? Make it whatever you need to do. So that, I mean, the whole straw man argument with Ford, I'm going to pass a law. It's like, there are ways to approach this. It's like, well, could you, you know, the money raised from poppies through the Legion is to go to veterans. And I don't know, maybe it is a reflection of the shortcomings of successive governments that they have let veterans down for years and years and years, and maybe they're embarrassed by that. So, well, we need to support the troops. It's like, well, like it's like you say, which troops? The active ones, the ones that get. I was thinking about, was it a few years ago in town where they said veterans can ride the bus for free? Like, why didn't they do that in 1946, right? Or 1952. Mm-hmm. No, they wait 70 years when there's like, we're running, you know, the veterans time is, I would say within 10 years or maybe less, there isn't going to be anybody left from World War II.
Well, 75 this year.
So. Yeah, exactly. So it's like the youngest people or people that lied about their age is still around. But anyway, so I, you know, that kind of extending that sort of thing to a ton of people isn't necessarily going to apply to. Does it really accomplish anything? I don't know. But we need, regardless of how you feel about war and conflict and your biases on that, and should we have gone, once somebody has gone and served, we have to take care of them, right? Mm-hmm. That is our obligation as a society to do that. But it's amazing that they're, you know, trying to remember this has become so difficult. And I hope. I hope this isn't one of our topics next year when we're sitting here that we're going to be talking about, oh, God, it happened again and it was somewhere else. As they say, lest we forget, right? So anyway, till next year, I guess. We'll be back shortly after some messages and a little bit of music. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. Going to take a little bit of a break. Be back in short order. So please stay tuned. Sleep at night, but he can't. Holy cow. cow, that's some big production. I kind of forgot. That was the Hollies. You would think I was going to name check King Midas. I did. That was, song was called King Midas in reverse. I ended up watching a special on them because we got Amazon Prime to watch Borat. And I watched a thing about the Hollies as well. I slid into DJ mode there, Adam. Sorry about that. Just more pertinent to the theme of today, you spoke to Mike Schreiner.
I did. We're going to talk about the pandemic, and we're going to talk about the budget that was released last week. I do have an additional statement from Mike Schreiner that I was asked to read before we play the interview. And he says, and I quote, "This interview was recorded on Tuesday. I tried to be measured in my critique of the government, and I believe this interview reflects that approach. However, with the news that emerged today about how the Ford government rejected its own public health agency's advice when it launched its color-coded plan for COVID-19 restrictions, it's important to call the government out on that, and I would have done so if this interview had been recorded today." So there you go.
Wow, a late-breaking addendum. Well, that's that. Well, I'm very excited to listen now. So let's get to that now.
Well, Mike Schreiner, thank you again so much for joining me today.
It's always a pleasure, Adam. I certainly appreciate the good work that local journalists do in our community.
Oh, well, thank you. I'll always take a plug when I get one. we're going to start that Yelp page for local journalists any day. I wanted to start by, throwing your words back in your face a bit, and then, you know, if you can expand about it. On Friday, you said that the budget holds the line on inadequate COVID relief, and people might hear that, and then they might hear the other thing, which is that, you know, this budget had record spending, record deficits because of the record spending. For people who don't, you know, live and breathe politics like we do, those are probably two disparate thoughts. How is the budget inadequate in terms of its spending when the spending is at record levels?
Well, first of all, Adam, we're in a once in a lifetime, you know, public health crisis and economic crisis. And so I don't think anyone is going to criticize the government right now at either level, federal, provincial, or even local, that we're in very challenging fiscal positions. And I don't think people are going to be overly critical of either the provincial or federal governments for running record deficits. Obviously, municipal governments are not allowed to. And so I think now is the time that government needs to step up and support people and businesses, and especially small businesses, get through this pandemic. And so my concern is that there's some real missed opportunities in, I'm going to say, three key areas, though I can expand in some other areas, mm-hmm. that were critical for funding in this budget. The first being long-term care. I mean, the tragedy that, you know, we all witnessed and experienced during the first wave of COVID, with almost 2,000 of our loved ones unfortunately passing away due to COVID in long-term care homes. It is clear that we need to invest more in long-term care. And I've been pushing for a minimum 4 hours of care per day. Numerous reports for many years prior to COVID has said that, and post-COVID, we've had reports, including a recommendation from the government's long-term care commission. And so I was really happy to see the premier finally say, yes, the government's going to support 4 hours of care for long-term care residents. And then I was disappointed and surprised that it's an unfunded promise in the budget. And so if that commitment is a real commitment, I would have liked to have seen, and I think there should have been, dollars attached to it in the budget. They were not. And so, you know, that was deeply disappointing. The second area is in mental health. We already have a mental health crisis in Ontario with lack of timely access to services and supports. I mean, the wait time for children's mental health alone is 18 months, which is just completely unacceptable. And we know that we're heading into winter where people experience more mental health challenges at the same time that we're, you know, in the middle of the second wave of the pandemic and we have rising case counts. And so the demands on mental health services will be extremely high this winter and into the early spring. And the government itself, when Ford ran, he promised $3.8 billion over 10 years, which would be $380 million a year. And the budget only has $195 million for mental health. So $200 million short of the premier's own promise pre-pandemic, let alone the additional demands on mental health services. And I'm hearing it from so many people in our community and in this region about the need to invest more in mental health supports and services. And so for that to not be in the budget was really disappointing. And then the final one for me is to look at economic recovery. You know what? We all need some hope right now, Adam. Mm. And I realize, and I'll be the first to tell you that, you know, getting the virus under control and addressing the public health crisis has to be our number one priority. But I think we also have to be laying the foundation for economic recovery as well, especially if we're going to address the record deficit that the province is facing. And economic growth is one of the best ways to do that. And what we've heard over and over again from business leaders, economists, people who came to the Economic Recovery Committee over the summer, which I served on, was that investing in a building retrofit and home renovation program would be one of the best things the province could do for economic recovery. And I see it as multiple wins. If we can help, you know, homeowners and tenants and small businesses and public institutions retrofit buildings to make them more energy efficient, that will lower people's utility bills. It will also lower climate pollution and help us address the climate crisis. And if we include retrofits for to meet public health measures and also accessibility guidelines, we certainly have some public health benefits to that as well. It's also the kind of program that will just create thousands of jobs in every community in the province. And these are the kinds of jobs that you can't export, you know, to other countries or to low-wage jurisdictions. And so to me, having some sort of economic recovery piece in this budget now prepare us and lay the foundation for the spring and summer construction season was a huge missed opportunity for the government to help kickstart economic recovery.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack. But I'm looking at the economy, though, and I think you made some comment about this the other day, just about we have these new measures, these public health measures in effect. You know, we're here in Guelph, we're code yellow, other places are green, other places are orange, or Peel is still red. But there seems to be sort of, I'm not sure what you would call it. There seems to be at once this recognition that we are in the midst of a serious second wave. I can't remember the numbers today as we're recording on Tuesday, but the numbers are going up. We don't have a lockdown like we did in the spring, which, and I understand the reasons why, there is some science to say that lockdowns are ultimately not that effective. But at the same time, we're in this kind of neutral zone of recognizing there's a problem and not necessarily acting as if there's a problem. Are you feeling what I'm saying there?
Well, I think more importantly than what I'm feeling, that's what most public health experts are saying.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to follow the science and listen to public health expert advice, it does appear that there's some serious contradictions in the way the Ford government is moving forward. And it appears that this new color-coded system is actually creating more confusion than clarity for a lot of people. And a number of people, particularly in the healthcare sector, have raised concerns about the new approach. And I can only echo their concerns, quite frankly, is that it seems that before the government is going to seriously act, they're going to wait until the virus is out of control. And so what I'm hoping to do, and I want to be really clear, that my objectives in saying, hey, we need some stronger public health measures in those hotspot areas. So, you know, luckily Guelph isn't one of those yet or at the moment, and let's hope we don't become a hotspot in the future, is that if we can contain the virus and make sure it doesn't get out of control, then we can avoid significant lockdowns. Because I think from, you know, from an economic health standpoint, from a community connection standpoint, from a mental health standpoint, people want to avoid, and I think we should be taking actions to avoid the kind of lockdowns we saw in the spring. But if we don't take some actions now that are targeted in hotspot areas, this could get out of control, and then our only option might be a more severe lockdown. And so I'm calling on the Ford government to listen to public health advice, take some more aggressive approaches in those hotspot areas in order to avoid a lockdown, which I think, you know, will obviously have some devastating consequences to our economy, but also I think just to people's, you know, morale and mental health.
Mm-hmm. I think a big part of this too, and maybe you can offer some insight from your own dealings with the premier, is, I mean, we have places right now where you get kind of the worst of both worlds, where you get like kind of the Donald Trumps who both ignore the science and the problem is it, with the virus is getting out of control. Then you have the best of both worlds with people like Jacinda Ardern, who listens to science and has kept COVID relatively in check in New Zealand. And I look at Doug Ford and I think, do we have kind of like a mix of the best and the worst? Because he does these press conferences where he talks about the science and he talks about listening to scientists, but then he's also incredibly susceptible to restaurateurs and bar owners in places like Peel, where he, you know, wants to make sure that he keeps them on his best side, and as a result kind of waters down any public health measures that might be introduced.
Yeah, you know what, Anna, I'm going to be a bit empathetic with the premier for a second here.
Fair enough.
And then I'm going to be a little critical too, okay?
Okay.
But I think it's only fair. I mean, it's a tough job. I mean, you know, he's making, you know, life and death decisions, and it's very tough to balance, you know, how do you protect people's livelihoods and people's lives at the same time? And so, you know, I don't envy the position the premier's in. I think during the first wave of the pandemic, he did a pretty good job of responding quickly, you know, bringing in some pretty significant public health measures and lockdowns in really, you know, in unprecedented ways. And really the whole province and the whole country rallied behind the effort to contain the spread of the virus. I think where the premier started to, you know, had some slippage was over the summer, when he really should have been focused on preparing the province to prevent a second wave of the virus. And there's some significant areas where he just failed to do that. The first is in testing and contact tracing. You know, over the summer, we should have been making more investments in testing lab capacity, as well as in our public health units for them to be able to do contact tracing. So the fact that, you know, we hit the fall and we didn't have enough testing and lab capacity really set us back. And we should have known that between, you know, schools restarting and people needing to test for that, people wanting to visit their loved ones in long-term care and requiring testing for that, and then just the broader general reopening of our economy was going to place more demand on testing, we should have been better prepared. And the fact that, you know, jurisdictions like Toronto, for example, just in some cases gave up on contact tracing because they just didn't have the resources to do it, just showed to me that we weren't ready for the second wave. The second area is in long-term care, and it gets back to my point around 4 hours of care. BC and Quebec hired additional staff in long-term care over the summer months. The Ford government dragged its feet, didn't announce its intentions even to hire additional staff until we were well into the second wave. And it's just been in the last week or so that they've taken the measures that BC and Quebec took over the summer, saying, hey, you know, we'll retrain, laid off hospitality staff and get you into our long-term care homes. And so I think we just were failed to properly prepare there. And then the third area is with our schools. We should have followed public health advice. The sick kids report that the government based much of its back to school plan on said the key element was having class sizes of around 15 students per class so we could have proper physical distancing. And the fact that, you know, in some cases we have classrooms of 30 students just doesn't meet what the needs of the moment to make sure that we've made those investments to keep our kids safe and our schools safe and the educators who work in those schools safe. And so the failure to make those investments and to take those actions over the summer has meant that we weren't as prepared for the second wave as we are now. And now we're feeling the consequences of that in places like Toronto, Ottawa, Peel, York, where you're seeing, you know, incredibly high rising case counts. And so now the premier is going to have to act to contain those. And so in order to do that, we're going to have some measures in place to support small businesses. And I will say, and you know, the budget contains some things to support small businesses, one of which I've been calling for a decade, raising the employer health tax exemption to $1 million to help small businesses with cash flow. It's finally, I finally feel like, okay, I'm going to declare a victory on this one after literally 10 years of advocating for this, to see it permanently in the budget. And then some of the measures to help municipalities provide some property tax relief to small businesses. Those are good measures. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, we need to do what small businesses have been asking for, is in those small businesses in hotspot zones that are being forced to, you know, have restrictions placed on them to help save lives. I think we should compensate them with direct financial support to help save them for the work they're doing to help contain the spread of the virus. And I think if the premier was willing to make some of those kinds of investments, he could do a better job of balancing, you know, protecting people's livelihoods while at the same time protecting people's lives.
I think that is kind of a piece that's missing, is that we're kind of presenting businesses with the option of be open or be closed, and there's nothing in the middle. And then they're forced to, you know, look at some data that indicates that, you know, the majority of these new cases are coming not from people going to a restaurant or, you know, hanging out together, walking past each other at the grocery store, but are coming from private gatherings now, which, other than bylaws and those kind of measures, it's you can't really shut down private residents like you can shut down restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the challenge is we're looking at this too much as an either or rather than a both and choice. And so I think if we can say, hey, we don't want to have a lockdown, and so we're going to bring in some, you know, restrictions to prevent a lockdown, and we're going to provide direct financial supports to those businesses that are having restrictions placed on them. And if we can keep up this messaging of us all being united and speaking with one voice, I think one of the challenges, particularly when it comes to some of the private residence gatherings, is, you know, there is COVID fatigue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm feeling it. I think we're all feeling it. You know, it's like we just want this over with. But part of the challenge is you've got, you know, public health officer in Toronto saying one thing, and the chief medical officer of health in Ontario saying something else, and then, you know, Teresa Tam federally saying something else, and you've got like a mayor in one place, like, you know, John Tory saying one thing and Doug Ford saying another thing, and it's like we need to get everyone back on the same page again, delivering a consistent, clear public health message, because I think in some respects the public is understandably a bit confused about what it is that, you know, we're supposed to be doing. So I just want to say in Guelph, I think in Guelph, we've been able to largely avoid that because I think Dr. Mercer, for one, has done a fantastic job and has been out in the forefront, especially on masking. You know, we were one of the first, if not the first jurisdiction to bring in, you know, a mandatory mask ruling. And also I feel like Mayor Guthrie and MP Longfield and I have been pretty much on the same page. And it would be nice if we could see maybe the premier and the mayor and the, you know, the Toronto Public Officer of Health, the Peel Health Officer, and the Provincial Health Officer all being on the same page, because I think having that consistent message is really important.
I remember an interview with Dr. Mercer. I think it was probably right before the pandemic started, where she said something to that effect, that the public health message has to be consistent no matter who you're getting it from. I wanted to just briefly touch on a local topic of sort of COVID prevention. The assessment center in Guelph is now down at Southgate Drive, and I've seen a lot of people talk about this on social media, that it's a bit of a slog to get to if you do not have your own private automobile. I mean, you don't run it, obviously, but I mean, people do come to you for advice about the local response. So, I mean, is there any, I guess, for people who are concerned about having to get on a transit bus to go and get tested and, you know, recognize the dangers there, you know, what kind of additional testing capacity do you think there might be for Guelph?
Yeah, it's a good question, Adam. And you know what? I have spoken, and I'm in regular contact with Ross about, you know, the testing center, and I'll continue to convey those concerns. I think one of the game changers is that Precision Biomonitoring, based here in Guelph, just had their rapid test approved by Health Canada. And I know from my conversations with them that they can right now have the capacity to produce 1 million rapid tests a week, and they could ramp that production up, provided they have, you know, contracts from provincial and federal governments. So I've been pushing really hard for the provincial government to, you know, purchase and contract with Precision Biomonitoring. I've had some really productive meetings with the Minister of Health, even with the Premier directly, as well as the Minister for Long-Term Care, because Precision's production facilities, actually their factory, is in her riding. And my hope is if we can get these rapid tests, you know, produced, ramped up, purchased, and out in our communities, that'll be a big game changer for Guelph and for the whole province and the whole country, quite frankly, because getting our testing capacity up is, to me, key to containing the spread of the virus and avoiding lockdowns, which, you know, I think we all want to avoid. And so that's where my focus is right now, is ramping up, rolling out, and getting those rapid tests in place. And if they're in place, then we can have multiple locations that will be more accessible to people, because the accessibility issue is a real concern that we need to address.
That is all the time I have for you, Mike, today, but I do appreciate all the time you can give, and thanks again for all your hard work and for talking to us about it today.
Hey, Adam, it's always a pleasure, and just so you know, and I'm not trying to butter you up here, but I do follow your live tweeting from city council meetings, which I think is really important, you know, keeping me informed, but keeping our whole community informed. So I appreciate you and all the other, your competitor journalists as well, you know, so it's not just you, but local journalism is so important all the time, but I think especially during this pandemic.
I'm going to leave that in. So thank you, Mike.
you can tell why Mike is always welcome on our show. That was Guelph MPP and leader of the Green Party of Ontario, Mike Schreiner. So, Adam, speaking of rapid, we are rapidly running out of time. So could you
good segue.
Yeah. Could you just tell the good people how they can reach you and find out what you do for local journalism in this town?
Yes, I'm at Guelph Politico at guelphpolitico.ca, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can find us live or semi-live from our respective bunkers at Thursdays at 5 right here on CFRU for Open Sources Guelph, plus all of the other places mentioned. So thank you once again for joining us. Please join us next week. And yeah, take care, have a good week, and stay safe.